Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to today's podcast here on a nice, beautiful Wednesday afternoon here in Chicago. In today's segment, we have the honor and the privilege of talking with Mr. Snehal Antony. He's the CEO and co-founder of Horizon3.ai. They're a leading cybersecurity firm that specializes in autonomous penetration testing. Snehal, thanks for joining us today.
Robbie, great to be back on. I'm excited to catch up with you in the audience.
Cool. Now, Snehal, we had you on a podcast before, but for those who may not know you or for those who may not have heard the first podcast, could you give us a brief background about yourself and your company, Horizon3.ai?
Yeah, for sure. So my background, I'm a security practitioner by trade and a developer by education. So I was a developer at IBM on the WebSphere products early in my career. I was a CIO at GE Capital and helped to lead a digital transformation there, including applying DevSecOps to our app development side. I was the CTO at Splunk, and I helped grow and scale that company, dealing with advanced security use cases, IoT use cases, and all the other awesome things that Splunk does. And then I took a break from industry in 2017, and I joined the U.S. Special Operations Committee. So I took a break from industry to serve within national security, where part of my responsibility was securing, operating, and defending our mission-critical networks, amongst other tasks that I had. And in each of those jobs, I had no idea I was secure until the attacker showed up and tried to breach us. And by then, it was too late. So my mission became, how do I proactively verify my security posture before the bad guys show up? How do I know I'm logging the right data, I'm fixing the right vulnerabilities, or that my security team knows how to react to an incident and they've already built the muscle memory so they're not learning how to deal with the crisis during the crisis? And that's where this idea of autonomous pen testing came into play, which was, how do I give an IT admin, a network engineer, or a 9-year-old the power of a 20-year pen testing veteran in 3 clicks? So self-service pen tests, no agents to install, allowing you to continuously find, fix, and verify security problems.
Excellent. Can you give us a kind of brief overview into Node Zero, so what it can do specifically, like the features and the benefits?
Yeah, so think of this difference between automated and autonomous. So I'll give you a couple of examples first, and I'll talk about how that translates to Node Zero. So in automated, think of when IBM played Garry Kasparov in chess a bunch of years ago. IBM didn't hard code 40 million chess games and say, oh, Garry must be playing game number 12, right? What they looked at was every piece on the board after every move and determined the next best action. It was autonomous in how it played, and that IBM was able to adapt as the game evolved. Or think of automated driving cars or autonomous driving cars. In an automated driving car, you're going to explicitly say, go in reverse for 20 feet to drive, turn right, go straight 100 feet, turn left at the next light. And then you're going to hit play, and the car will do exactly as you instructed. It'll back up, turn right, and then it'll run into a pedestrian, because nowhere in your automation did you say, don't hit the pedestrian that was there. Whereas if you have an autonomous driving car, you're going to say, start from point A, get to point B, and get there with these constraints in place, and the car is going to figure it out. At least that's how my Tesla does it. So the difference between automated pen testing is somebody had to hard code a bunch of attacks. But when your environment changes, you've got to update those attack scripts. And that was really the failure of the breach attack simulation space, like Veridin, Safe Breach, Attack IQ, Pantera, and so on, is they were all automated. You had to tell it what to do. We are autonomous. You tell us nothing about your environment. There is no cheating. There's no agents to install. And you say, go. And then we will figure out how to conduct reconnaissance. We'll build out a knowledge graph that represents the entire cyber terrain that we've been discovering. We will then figure out, how do I harvest credentials from one place and combine that with misconfigurations in Jenkins or vCenter in another, and then use that in combination with the vulnerability to become a domain administrator. And all of that is happening adaptively and dynamically. So if your environment changes, like you're in the cloud, your environment's changing all the time, or you're on-prem, but you're doing DevSecOps practices and your environment's changing regularly, the attack algorithms adapt to find other ways to compromise. So you don't have to hard code or maintain any scripts. And that's really the big difference under the covers and why we are autonomous pen testing versus automated attack scripts.
Okay, that's awesome. Now, Stahel, as we know, when Russia invaded the Ukraine, there was a lot of fear here in the U.S. that there could be a horrible attack on our critical infrastructure, like simultaneous attack where water will be cut off, they'll hit our national grid, we'd lose electricity for weeks. Now, knock on wood, luckily nothing has happened yet. But in the meantime, it doesn't mean to say that the cyber world has come to a stop yet. There's still threats out there, there's still attacks happening, but certain segments are getting really hit hard. One of them is the healthcare sector, obviously. Now, what has Horizon3.ai done in its effort to help mitigate these risks? We'll do a deeper dive in some case studies here eventually, but I just want to know on a holistic level, like what has your company done to kind of help mitigate these risks for healthcare clients?
Yeah, so there's three parts to that answer. The first part, let's just talk about the Russia-Ukraine and the state of cyber warfare in general first. So in national security, in strategic competition, there's this concept of the threshold of war. What is an attack that would exceed the threshold of war and trigger boots on the ground? And the general belief and doctrine is an attack that causes massive loss of life exceeds that threshold of war and would trigger military action. So a cyber attack that causes a plane to crash or a train to derail, that causes massive loss of life. You should expect the 82nd to get spun up and go do what the 82nd does. However, most cyber attacks or all cyber attacks thus far have been below that threshold of war. So a cyber attack to cause fruit to spoil or to cause a shortage of insulin or to cause gas prices to spike, none of those cyber attacks are going to trigger a military response. And so what we should expect to see at the nation state level is cyber-enabled economic warfare, where if through sanctions we prevent the Russians from traveling, the Russian counterpunch is to hack and destroy the American Airlines ticketing database, because that is going to cause a similar effect as the sanctions, but it won't cross the line that causes a military response. If we prevent the Russians from selling oil, they can turn around and compromise or hack refineries and pipelines and cause gas prices to spike to $50 a gallon. So what we will see, I think, is cyber-enabled economic warfare out in the open between a nation state like the Russians, where their job isn't to extort a company for ransom, which is what we've seen criminal gangs do, but rather their goal is to cause economic damage and harm below that threshold of war. So I think that's going to really change the posture from a peacetime security mindset to a wartime mindset. So with that said, we still have criminal gangs to deal with. We still have ransomware to deal with, and we've got nation states coming after us. So in healthcare, there are a couple of issues. The one part is healthcare organizations are barely treading water. They often don't have a big security budget. They most definitely lack security talent, and they often rely on third-party providers to make sure that they're secure, MSSPs and so on. Well, how do you know these third-party providers are actually doing their job? So one thing that healthcare companies use us for is to audit their MSSP. So they will run us as a no-notice pen test, and they will wait to see how long it takes for their SOC or security provider to detect and respond. One healthcare company ran us, and they were using Dell SecureWorks as their MSSP. It took Dell SecureWorks almost 7 hours to detect and respond to our presence. Egregiously violating the SLA that they had in place with that healthcare company. And that triggered a very direct and unpleasant conversation between the healthcare firm and Dell SecureWorks. And they used us to audit and hold their providers accountable for what they bring to the table. The second use case here is if you do have capacity to buy your own security tools and you're going to use Splunk for your SIEM, CrowdStrike for your EDR, and so on and so forth, well, these are all great tools, but none of them were really designed to work together. And it's very easy to misconfigure them, and attackers know this, and they attack at the seams. So the second use case is verifying your security tools are actually working. One healthcare company Fortinet as their EDR, but it was misconfigured on 3 machines out of 1,000. Well, when they ran a Node Zero pen test, we were able to get remote code execution on those 3 machines, successfully dump LSAS, which is a very critical password process on Windows, and then use that to elevate to become domain admin. And when they looked at the Node Zero results and saw the actual proof that we did it, they started having conversations with Fortinet of, hey, wait a minute, guys, your product was supposed to stop this. Why didn't it do it? And it turned out it was misconfigured on 3 boxes. And they would not have known that until the bad guys had showed up, and at least they were able to proactively harden their systems. I've got more stories to tell, but I'll pause there. Let me get your thoughts and feedback.
Yeah, I think it's great. Now, the two areas that, you know, that I'm, you know, being the writer that I've come across when I'm writing articles and, you know, white papers for clients on healthcare security, the big two are on the protection of the PHI data sets. Now, that's obviously different than what are called PII data sets. Here we're talking like personal healthcare information records. Now, that could be like, you know, x-rays, electrocardiogram records or anything. And what's worse even yet is a scary thought is if a cyber attacker actually gets access to this stuff, they can actually then tap into a patient who may have like an implanted medical device and really wreak havoc on that. That's where the role of medical device cybersecurity comes into play. So, for example, if a cyber attacker refines some like a patient record of like a pacemaker, they can wreak havoc, you know, on a patient and literally cause them to die, which would be totally unfortunate. And the other thing is the ransomware and the phishing attack. It seems like, you know, phishing is always going to be there. It's going to be there forever. But the ransomware attacks are becoming more brutal in nature. It's not just simply going in there, you know, doing smash and grab campaign, taking out, you know, the data sets. Now it's going in, staying in for a long period of time, taking out PHI data sets without people noticing it, going onto the dark web, selling it, but worse yet is actually going through extortion campaigns after, you know, the systems have been locked. And that's another, you know, scary thought right there too. So if you can do a deeper dive into how Node Zero is actually kind of played in these two cyber threats, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I think let's break that up into two pieces. So the first piece is the PHI data. So take a large data medical provider like Allscripts. So there was a medical facility that we were working with that was an Allscripts customer. Now, a common misconfiguration is misconfiguring your LLMNR, MBTNS, kind of DNS-level misconfig. And what this misconfiguration will do is when service one is trying to call service two, they will do a standard DNS lookup, but they'll also do a multicast push. And that multicast is going to say, hey, service two, are you out there? And then service two will say, hey, here I am. And then service one will say, great, here are my credentials, my user ID and my hash password. I would like to access you. And that's how multicast-based DNS works. Well, it's a misconfiguration. It's very unsafe, because an attacker can turn on a tool like Responder, which is a hacker tool you can find on the web. Responder will respond to every single multicast request as if it was the calling service. And what it's doing is basically man-in-the-middle DNS poisoning type attack. And so when service one says, hey, service two, are you out there? Responder says, yep, here I am. Service one says, oh, great, here is my user ID, here is my hashed password. And then Responder will take the hash and the user ID and then not respond. And then the calling service will time out and then move on to the next thing. But what Responder did was it collected the hash. And what an attacker can do is collect enough hashes and then start to find ways to crack them. So that is kind of the background for this particular attack that we did, that Node Zero did at a healthcare facility where we turned on Responder, multicast, misconfiguration, grabbed a bunch of hashes. Well, one of the user ID passwords that we got and we cracked was a user ID and password to the service account for their Allscripts database, which meant we were able to log in. Node Zero could log in to Allscripts as a valid domain user and gain access to billions of medical records that Allscripts had available. That's the reality of attackers. They don't have to hack in. Usually they can just log in because they've harvested credentials from one place and reused them somewhere else. So that is all medical record, PHI data, that is at risk. It's not about data in motion, data in rest. Like, we're all pretty good at securing that part of it. Domain user credentials, that can be compromised through a bunch of different techniques that give the attacker legitimate access to sensitive data on the back end. Usually it never even trips a single security alert.
Okay, excellent. Now, how about the ransomware and phishing attacks?
So there's two parts, right? One is phishing. Phishing is the attacker is going to get in. You just have to accept that people are going to get phished. The phishing attacks are getting more sophisticated. They're coming in through SMS. They're coming in through WhatsApp. They're coming in through a variety of mechanisms that look very legitimate. So if you operate with the assumption that the attacker is going to get in, now what, and build your defense in depth strategy around assuming initial access, it becomes a focus less of preventing the phishing to begin with and more defending or improving your defensibility to stifle the attacker from achieving their objective. Anybody that says they're going to stop phishing is on a fool's errand. There's just no way you're going to do it. People are there's just too many people with too much diversity in their security hygiene, and the attackers are very good at it. Ransomware, different beast. Phishing is for initial access. Ransomware is the effect. Now that you're in, what can you do? Well, as an attacker, if you get domain user access to data, like I described through that LLMNR example for Allscripts, or you've got a lot of data that's open on open share drives or other things that give right access to the attacker at scale, you're susceptible to ransomware. So it's all about data protection. It's what is your data recovery strategies? Where are you duplicating that data? How do you prevent right access at scale? And that's more of just standard security hardening and security resilience. That is basic blocking and tackling that organizations have to put in place.
Okay, excellent. Now, on your website, there are a couple of case studies I'm hoping you can do a deeper dive into and give us and our audience more information. The first one's My EDR Should Have Caught That. Can you do a deeper dive into what the case study was about and what the problem was and what the solution was in the end?
Yeah, so that was the Fortinet example I talked about earlier. So they had this particular medical facility had 1,000 hosts in their environment, you know, typical medical center type size, and three of them were misconfigured where Fortinet was installed but not running properly. And we were able to successfully get code execution, dump LSAS. Now, here's the sad part. Here we successfully proved we could dump LSAS, gain access to their user ID passwords, and elevate privileges. The healthcare company then said, hey, wait, but Fortinet, your marketing brochure says you can stop lateral movement. And Node 0 clearly laterally maneuvered. So why did you not stop them even though the EDR was misconfigured? And then Fortinet looked at the proof and looked at all we did, their support team, and came back and said, oh, I'm sorry, healthcare company. Actually, you didn't buy the right modules of the product. And so we probably could have stopped it if you bought these other SKUs. And that was a very uncomfortable conversation that we got to witness, because the last thing you want to hear as a CIO or a CISO, and having been one, I can tell you from personal experience, is I got breached because your marketing said one thing, but your sales rep sold me something else. That ain't going to fly. So that is just the reality of the state of security and security sales is don't trust what your tools and marketing brochures are telling you. Verify that your tools are actually working to prevent the attack. So that's kind of, you know, case study one. The second case study is another healthcare facility where they did everything right, tool that Gartner told them to buy in the Magic Quadrant. They installed them, they spent tons of money, and they had a very robust patching strategy. Well, they patched zero logon, which is a very dangerous, easy to exploit 9.8 severity CVE that came out in 2020. And zero logon allows an attacker to, with minimal effort, become a domain admin in the environment. And so this healthcare company applied the patch, and Microsoft and Qualys both reported that zero logon was indeed patched in green and good to go. So they run a self-service pen test with Node 0. Node 0 successfully exploits zero logon to become domain admin. And immediately the healthcare company says, no way, this is a false positive. I don't believe you. And then they saw the proof and they saw the path and they saw the actual command and they could rerun that command themselves and see that we compromised the environment. When they looked, what they realized is the zero logon patch has two steps. Step one is update the registries to show that the patch has been applied. Because all the reporting tools, they only looked at the registry values of the Windows environment. Step two was to apply the actual binary and fix. Well, Cylance blocked the binary from being applied. So the registries were updated. All the reporting tools did it. But none of those reporting tools actually do exploitation and verification. So this healthcare company has been misreporting their patch status for 18 months. Really big deal. So now, after every patch Tuesday, they have a pen test Wednesday to verify that indeed their patches have applied and that they have not exposed themselves to any other critical exploitation.
Oh, wow. Excellent. Now, do you have any other use cases you can talk about, please, in the healthcare industry?
Yeah, probably. And this last one is, it goes back to your medical devices. So this is actually manufacturing, but relates to healthcare. So during the height of COVID, all the manufacturing companies had to rapidly integrate COVID temperature sensing machines into their badge reading process, right? So you'd walk into the office, you'd swipe your badge to gain access, and then you'd have to take put your face in front of a thermal camera to make sure you don't have a fever. And organizations rapidly incorporated these devices into their network. Well, these devices, several manufacturers of them, had a misconfiguration Android debugging bridge turned on. And when that is turned on, it allows any attacker to quickly go from unauthenticated user to admin and then domain admin in the network because of the way the credentials are stored on the device and other things like that. So because of a medical reason, or health reason, they had to rapidly integrate these devices onto the network without having the proper vetting to make sure that it was secure. Because this manufacturing company shifted from wanting one pen test a year to 40 pen tests a month, within a few hours, Node Zero found this temperature sensor, found the debugging bridge turned on, exploited it, elevated to domain admin, and was able to provide that path proof and impact. So what otherwise would have been a catastrophic exposure that would have led to a massive breach had it not been remediated, within a few hours, it was discovered and fixed on the network. And this holds true for any medical device. The problem with the medical device industry is that most of these devices did not have security by design up front. Often security was an afterthought. In fact, the default credentials for GE medical equipment and healthcare gear is all available online to go find. Because those service accounts for remote administration of those devices, they never thought about it from a security standpoint. And so there's massive exposure in all of these healthcare systems of default credentials for very
right.
sensitive machines that are attached to the network.
Yeah, it seems like it's a big problem with these vendors. I mean, I think these medical devices, they're trying to adopt the framework of the IoT, the Internet of Things, where it's easier for the medical practitioner. If they're going to update one thing, it'll automatically trigger updates into other devices or whatever the patient might be using, to save time and administrative headaches on their end. But the one thing is, apart from not taking security consideration, one thing is, I think I kind of have to find fault on part of the healthcare practitioner or the organization is, they just leave things at the default settings. They don't take the effort to really determine, okay, where does this thing really be at for maximum security? Am I correct in my hypothesis with that?
Yeah, not only the medical industry. I mean, the way that you install vCenter by default from VMware is it's insecure by default. When I worked at IBM, WebSphere versions 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 were insecure by default. And you had to go in and explicitly set up the security. So a part of it is the vendors themselves. They are not accountable for or liable for the security posture of their products. And also, they're not motivated to secure their products because they're not liable. So I remember in 2006, when I was at IBM, where the senior executive for the WebSphere product said, no, we are not going to have security turned on by default because our performance numbers suck when it's on by default, and we need to beat WebLogic and show that we do better, more transactions per second than they do, so we're going to do it with security turned off. I'm like, guys, this is the wrong metric to optimize for. A marketing number that shows we can do 10% more transactions per second over WebLogic because it's unsecure and all the encryption is turned off. Of course you're going to be faster. You know, so we have a vendor problem where they are not incentivized to keep their products secure, and we have an adoption problem. The implementation of that product is either done rapidly or with people of insufficient experience or whatever else, that it is insecure because of these dangerous defaults. And I'll tell you a story I was super sad about. I surfaced to the chief security officer at VMware a couple months ago. I said, sir, I think vCenter is the next SolarWinds. It is I'm a vCenter customer for 15 years when I was a CIO and all my other jobs. I said, this product has significant placement and access across DoD and the intelligence community and all these other critical banks, and it's super hard to misconfigure. And, you know, I think this is going to be a big deal. Let's work together to figure out how to proactively harden all of the systems of your vCenter shops. And his answer was, if my customers can't read the documentation and secure the product themselves, it's their problem, not mine. Because that's the vendor mindset. And so what do we do to change the vendor mindset and the practitioner mindset to care about security, especially, once again, the Russians are coming? So what do we do to shift that point of view?
Well, what do you think is going to take to motivate these people, other than having, you know, the fear of audits and, you know, and facing a huge, huge financial penalty? It seems like even when companies are hit with a financial penalty, they still don't care. That's just from what I've seen when I've written, you know, on articles and when I see the headlines. What do you think, as a practitioner,
yeah,
is going to take for these?
I think there's three parts to it. So the first part is that you know, and this is something that's been talked about on the Hill, legislation that increases the liability and burden on vendors to be accountable for their security posture. And we saw that, by the way, in the state of California, where they actually, I think, legislated any IoT devices for use in California cannot have default credentials hard-coded.
Right.
Into, right. You know, that's kind of one. A second part of it, though, is putting the burden on the adopters of this tech, which is don't trust that things are secure, verify that they're secure, and then verify it again tomorrow, and then verify it again next week, right? So I think that's another key part of it. And then the third part of it is how do we improve our operational collaboration? What I mean by that is your attack surface is no longer your enterprise IT and your cloud, because if, let's just say back to wartime, the intent of Russian cyber attacks is not to extort you through ransomware. It's to destroy your business in retaliation for Ukraine. And so now you're talking about the destruction of value and revenue and jobs and economic effects. And so not only are you under attack or at risk, but even if you manufactured your product, if you can't distribute it, you're not going to get paid. If you can't manufacture because your supplier was attacked, you're not going to get paid. So your attack surface is now inclusive of your suppliers and your distributors. And how do you start to build the right operational collaboration upstream and downstream so that you are protecting your revenue risk and cash flow up and down versus creating weaknesses for economic attack?
Excellent. Now, what other vulnerabilities has Node Zero found in the healthcare industry, apart just from the usual ones that we've just discussed in this podcast? Have you made any other discoveries, like any threat variants that come out? Hey, can you elaborate on those if you can?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts. One is, you know, I despise the term vulnerability because vulnerability often is believed to be CVEs, right? An actual named CVE from the government that this is a product defect that needs to be fixed, and it will be patched in some version. Because attackers don't need CVEs to compromise your environment. Once again, if you misconfigure your vCenter that allows unencrypted backups, that is not a CVE. VMware won't accept that as a problem with how you implemented it. So what you have are misconfigurations, dangerous product defaults, weak default or reuse credentials, and CVEs. And it is the combination of the four that allow attackers to achieve their objectives. And so now the question is, well, how do you proactively improve your credential policies to make sure you don't have reused or easily crackable credentials? How do you get into security configuration hardening so that you're getting rid of those dangerous defaults and reducing those misconfigurations? And how are you focusing on vulnerabilities that are actually exploitable versus just vulnerable? And it is it's the holistic approach that incorporates those four pieces that we have to improve across the board, especially in healthcare.
Okay, excellent. Now, obviously you can't give out too much confidential information on this, so what kind of further enhancements for updates, upgrades, or what have you, do you have planned for Node Zero when it comes to the healthcare industry?
So there's two parts that I think are very compelling. And kind of the precursor to that is Node Zero is very good. It is the best. In fact, Node Zero has never lost in a competitive bake-off with another product before. Never. We have 100% competitive win rate because the product is awesome. We are very good at self-service pen tests today. What we're adding and what we're focused on is, okay, now show me pen test results over time so that I, as a CIO or a CISO, can look at not just the point-in-time pen tests or diff it from today versus yesterday, but I want to know how many critical impacts were found, how quickly were they remediated, and how often did they reoccur. Because as a CIO or a GRC, that's going to help me understand the systemic problems I have in the company, systemic policy issues, patching issues, training issues, and so on. So what we're really doing is a lot of analytics around pen test results over time. That's going to be a major one. And the second one is around perspectives. And what I mean by that is assume the attacker can get into your guest network. From that perspective, could they break out of the guest network and compromise my financial data? Excuse me. Now, what about from the perspective of my offshore development team? At GE, we had massive amounts of offshore engineering resources working on code. What if an attacker compromises that offshore subnet? Could they break out and compromise my crown jewels GE aviation data? And so on. So the other thing we're working on is this idea of perspectives. So running pen tests from different perspectives or spots in the organization, and then being able to look at those results over time so that you as a CIO or a CISO or the board can put together an annual campaign plan for security testing and validation and verifying your controls, and then quickly seeing your results over time to help justify security spend and help prove to regulators your self-identified findings, the effectiveness of your policies, and all the other things that other tools, you know, think of a security scorecard. I was a customer of them. Those tools are garbage in, garbage out. It's a bunch of humans inputting a bunch of fields. You hit the calculator and out comes your magic security score. Well, that security score was completely dependent on the human input. How do you get to very accurate reporting of your environment based on actual exploitability? And that's really what we're going to be getting into next.
Yeah, excellent. Now, I'm seeing a lot of companies after COVID-19, I think healthcare industries are now starting to pick up on this bandwagon here, is moving from a 100% on-prem to a off-prem, like using cloud, like AWS or Azure. Now, this may seem like a kind of silly question, but I just want to ask it anyway. Can Node Zero be used to pen test something within a cloud infrastructure like Microsoft Azure? Suppose you have a private deployment there of healthcare data. You got a bunch of VMs and VDs set up. Can you actually do a pen test on that, or does Microsoft kind of like poo-poo on that? Or
That's an awesome question. So actually, there's a couple of layers to that answer. So first, think about there's really three cloud strategies that you see out there. The first is your cloud native, and you're using native Lambda services on AWS, for instance, and native S3 buckets, and you're executing. And you are not allowed to actually pen test the underlying Lambda service from AWS. because that's an AWS service. What you are allowed to do is attack the code, your own custom code. So that's where you see a lot of static and dynamic security testing and other types of code-level attacks. You are allowed to look at misconfigurations that allow for access to data, so you've got S3 buckets that aren't configured properly or not locked down. And oftentimes in cloud-native environments, the primary attack vector is misconfigurations and defaults. So that's what you end up looking for. And you also look in from the external perspective of, can I break in because they had misconfigured subdomains and other things like that. The second cloud scenario is a migration situation where a customer is on-prem and they're in the cloud and they've connected the two environments together. And often you as an attacker can start on the on-prem side and you will find and pilfer the AWS admin tokens because they were stored on some shared drive in your on-prem environment. And once you've been able to pilfer those tokens or you pull them out of GitHub or whatever else, validly log in as an administrator into the cloud and not trigger any security alerts, and now you've got keys to the kingdom. And then the third security or cloud migration strategy is lift and shift, where you bought basically Amazon EC2 and you have purchased products like VMware or other virtualization layers that allow you to lift your, I call them cracklocations on-prem. You're going to lift your apps on-prem and then magically move them into the cloud. And in that case, all the common attack vectors you saw on-prem are now in the cloud environment as well. So it's going to depend. Like cloud native, it's mostly misconfigurations, defaults, and app level issues. The hybrid environment, it's often traversing from on-prem into the cloud as an administrator. And then lift and shift, it's all the same problems you had on-prem, just in someone else's environment.
Wow, okay. Cool. Now, one thing, Dale, when I first got started in the industry, I got started in biometrics, fingerprint recognition, iris recognition. The healthcare industry, because of HIPAA, they're now trying to implement, on a heavy scale, 2FA, MFA, and using fingerprint recognition, iris recognition, I think the latter now is starting to really gain popularity because it's a non-contactless tool. They're starting to use biometrics now for, three-step, four-step way of authenticating someone. For example, you enter a password, challenge response, and use an OTP, then have your iris scan. And with that, you're trying to map out the unique features of the iris onto a vector orientation on a geometric plane. And then you're trying to use like a Bohr wavelet mathematics to kind of break it down into the respective iris code. And the original founder of that was Dr. John Dogman from Cambridge University, so I'm kind of using his old terminology. But long story short, what do you think of using biometrics as a tool in the healthcare industry? And that's going to segue into our question I had is, they're trying to adopt a zero trust framework. I have some reservations about it, but for those organizations I've seen actually implement it, it seems like it's working to a certain degree. So what are your thoughts on both, like using biometrics as another means of the password and a zero trust framework?
Yeah, great question. Let's split those up. So multi-factor authentication, of course, is super important, and the more layers you put in, the harder it is to compromise. But, and a really big but, lower-level protocols like SMB don't require and don't support MFA. So while you might have an incredibly robust 3, 4, 5 layers deep factor authentication, those low-level legacy protocols don't support it at all, and attackers are just going to swim there instead. So that's just the reality. In fact, almost every organization Node Zero has successfully compromised had multi-factor in place. But it doesn't apply to SMB and other low-level protocols because that's just not in their purview. And most people don't realize because they don't have enough attacker knowledge or networking expertise and background to understand how these low-level protocols work and operate. That's kind of number one. Number two is zero trust. So let's think of zero trust as I give the right you get access to this data at the right time, the right location, from the right device because I know it's you and you have a need to know. I mean, that's really the constraints of least privileged access, identity-based access, and the network segmentation to make sure that you have a limited amount of accessibility and blast radius if you are compromised. But at the end of the day, zero trust is really about having a very good identity and access management infrastructure and having very strong network segmentation. Those are the two underlying key tenets of zero trust. Both of those, however, are achieved as a journey. You can't just hit a magic easy button and suddenly IAM is perfect. It takes years.
Right.
It took the intelligence community through the ISPIE program half a decade or longer just to get attribute-based access control in place. And, you know, now is a massive amount of money and energy. And it's perfect. It's excellent now, but it takes a long time to get there. And then for network segmentation, that is a massive undertaking because for years, networks were designed to be flat and open. And once you put in segmentation,
right,
there's a huge management burden and other things like that. So in both of those, what you want to do and what customers will use Node Zero for is take network segmentation. On January 1st, you have a flat open network and Node Zero is going to be able to reach everything. But on March 1st, you've started adding the segmentation. You're going to see Node Zero's reachability get reduced. Every 3 months, its reachability better get smaller and smaller and smaller. So by the end of the year, when you run Node Zero, instead of being able to reach 100,000 hosts, it can only reach 10 because you've properly segmented the network. And then from there, at the beginning of the year, maybe Node Zero could compromise a domain user credential and then gain access to all your sensitive data. But by the end of the year, as you've rolled out IAM practices and principles, even if Node Zero compromised the domain user account, it still can only access a small subset of the data that it allegedly needed to know at that time. And what you want to be able to do is continuously verify your zero trust journey, because that is a 1, 2, 3 year journey. And you don't want to flip a switch at the end and realize that you made a big mistake. You want to be continuously testing it along the way.
Excellent. Now, in closing, as we wrap up our show, Snail, what do you think the cyber threat landscape is going to look like for the healthcare industry in the near future? I don't forecast a very good one. I think they're going to get hammered, but even more. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have any specific ideas on it?
Yeah, so I'm going to give a parallel to the financial services customer we had just for a moment. So in 7 minutes and 19 seconds, Node Zero went from unauthenticated user to domain admin in the network. 7 minutes. No humans, no custom scripting, straight up autonomous attack. That healthcare company, or that financial services company, had every Gucci security tool you could buy for the SIM, CrowdStrike for the EDR, and so on. Yet not a single security alert was triggered. Because in cybersecurity, we don't have a tools problem. We have bought more tools than we need as CIOs and CISOs. What we have is an effectiveness problem. These tools need to be able to work together, and you've got to get the muscle memory and the basic blocking and tackling in place for your people and your processes, and they know how to use the tools that you've purchased in order to know that they're ready to stop a breach. And what you need in that scenario is a sparring partner like Node Zero that's going to be constantly fighting you to make sure that you can detect issues in seconds, you can remediate issues in minutes, and that you've built the muscle memory for incident response. So when the real thing happens, your team is ready to go. We've seen the financial services industry start to take this seriously, and they've invested heavily. I think the big thing for healthcare is investing to train like you fight, perfect and build that muscle memory for incident response, using a product like Node Zero as the sparring partner so that you know exactly what you can stop and how you can stop it before the bad guys show up.
Excellent, excellent. Now, Snehal, in closing, what is the best way for a prospect, customer, someone who just wants to know more about Node Zero? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
Excellent. So horizon3.ai is just come to the website. You're going to find tons of stuff. Horizon3.com also routes there. You can find me on LinkedIn, Snehal Antani. You can Google Horizon 3, Splunk CTO. You can, a variety of ways to find me. And reach out and connect with me on LinkedIn and send me messages. I'm pretty good about responding there too. But the best thing is to start at the website, and then honestly, in a few clicks, you can be running a pen test yourself without any professional services or consultants. once again, I've got a video of a 9-year-old doing it, which is pretty awesome. And just let our results do the talking. It's, you know, the, back to that kind of military mindset that underpins the culture of the company. It's let our results do the talking, run a pen test, be blown away at the problems that we found that you weren't aware of, and then go fix them, rerun that pen test again to verify you fixed it, and then you'll get a Horizon 3 tattoo because you'll be addicted.
That's awesome. Stay Hall, thank you for your time this afternoon. I know you're really busy, but thank you once again so much. We look forward to having you on another podcast. Okay. And we look forward to seeing you in Chicago next time.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely.
All right. Take care. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.